2 years ago today, a mob of Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol. Since then, nearly 1,000 people have been charged with crimes like assaulting police officers and damaging government property. Several leaders of the far right, Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, have been convicted. But what's the state of the far right in America today, 2 years after the insurrection? Joining us now is Kathleen Ballou, Northwestern University history professor and expert on far-right-wing extremism. She's a contributor to the new book, Myth America, Historians Take on the Biggest Legends and Lies About Our Past. Kathleen, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm sure many people were shocked by what they saw on January 6th. 2 years ago, there was a lot of brutality, 140 police officers injured. Really terrified staffers, congressional staffers, hiding under tables, inside closets. There were images of these rioters whacking on the windows to try and break them, using police protective shields. I mean, it was shocking. And yet, I wonder, in the 2 years since, what has happened to that shock, all of that raw violence? Did it actually inhibit or have any kind of negative effect on the far-right movement or their strength?
That's an excellent question, and we have to come at it from several different angles. The prosecutions that you led off with include an intense focus on far-right groups. So among those nearly 1,000 people charged, some 18 people have been charged for seditious conspiracy, meaning a conspiracy to overthrow the United States government. Those charges are very heavily focused on the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, who were a small part of the surge of people on January 6th, but wielded outsized influence because they were pre-organized, they were well prepared, and they led the breach on the building. That shows us what we knew even at the time, which is that a small extremist movement of white power and militant right activists has really effectively harnessed the sort of Trump moment to galvanize a whole bunch more people into extremist politics. Now, that has two faces. One is sort of public facing, oriented a little bit towards politics and mainstream action. The other is a violent underground. So when we're talking about the extremist right, we have to be thinking not only about the many signs that they were emboldened by January 6th, like Proud Boys showing up at school board meetings and library drag queen story hours, but also things like increases in hate crime, in anti-Semitic violence, and incidents like the shooting in Buffalo, which were all white power activists.
So experts have said that, including you, that disinformation and the ease with which it can be spread has really played a big role in building this movement. Have there been actions taken that might stem the spread of disinformation and therefore weaken the far right?
The problem of disinformation is important to this conversation, not only because it has supercharged the kind of movement building capacity of the far right through the ever more central role that internet and social media play in all of our lives, which is just, you know, it's a superhighway for this kind of hate speech. But it's also important because it dilutes our ability to tell the story of what happened and to effectively respond as a society. So when we think about January 6th, the question of why aren't we talking more about this anniversary today is partly because of what's going on in the House floor with these multiple elections, which are sort of prolonged into chaos by many of the same lawmakers who were in support of the idea that the 2020 election was a sham and even in support of the insurrection on January 6th itself. Now, why are those people still in office? Why do they still wield power over our political system? This is because we as a society have not been able to cohesively respond to what happened. The prosecutions are happening, but they take, as you see, a very long time to go through. And in the meantime, we have a response that ranges from denials like, oh, it was an ordinary tourist visit, to events like, you know, the January 6th committee report coming out and the Republicans involved in the report being routed out of the party and out of office. So we don't have a very good sort of cue that we have done the public history work, the public memory making needed to really understand what happened and effectively reorganize our society and our institutions around that truth.
Well, let's dig into maybe some of the strategies that might accomplish that. We heard of a number of people, some of them in court transcripts, who've question their own role in the riot. They say that they can't understand how they came to believe all that they believed. They're disillusioned with Donald Trump for having led them down that path. Is there any large-scale effort to deprogram people who have been misled?
This is an excellent question. And de-radicalization and sort of exit strategies from this kind of politics is one of the places where we really need more support. Some of this work is simply person-to-person outreach, and it really works on a one-to-one model. But it is also a disinformation problem. And by that, I mean, our most effective intervention might be upstream in figuring out how to do better education about how civics works, how elections function, better historical education about what is the reality of our country that we all come from, that we all live in. It's always striking to me that the United States is far from unique in our long, deep history of racial violence and racial segregation. But we are very strange in how little we have done in the way of having a public conversation about it. We don't have a big truth and reconciliation process where people have had the chance to sort of talk through these histories. And when we do see efforts to tell stories about the racial violence of our past, they tend to be very community focused. We need more of those stories. And one of the ways we know that is that the whole idea of Make America Great Again, at the end of the day, is a historical argument about who we are, about where we've come from, and about who's included, about what's greatness. We should be engaging that from the point of view of where we arise together.
On the other end of that spectrum, I guess, federal law enforcement officials say far-right extremism is the biggest threat to our national security. So what about law enforcement? Are the FBI and the Justice Department doing enough to fight far-right extremism?
So that's a very good point. So the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI have designated white power and militant right threats as the greatest national security threats for several years in a row now. All indications are that this is a growing problem, and the historical record would back that up. After major events of violence like the Oklahoma City bombing, we see surges in interest and activity. We don't see it just sort of disappearing and evaporating away. So that does mean that we need an institutional response from the FBI, DHS. I would add the Department of Defense, which is a major pipeline for recruitment. All of those agencies have responded to this threat in really hopeful and encouraging ways in the last 2 to 3 years. The problem here is that we are playing catch up with a movement that has been organizing since the late 1970s. We're so far behind the ball. The question is, can our institutions respond fast enough to combat a movement that is decades, if not generations, deep?
Well, let me just ask the question you just posed. Can they respond to this in time? If they're so far behind, is it possible?
I mean, I think that's the big question. It's a problem that's bigger than just one solution. We can't solve it just with, you know, redefining domestic terrorism, which is one idea that people talk about, or with devoting FBI and DHS resources, because this is something that needs to, we need to face this threat, which, by the way, is not only a threat to people of color, but a threat to American democracy itself. This threat is something that has to be faced down everywhere in our society, in journalistic representation, in schools, in surveillance agency resources, in radicalization, and beyond. And in our court system, there need to be changes so we can effectively counter the threat. So all of these places, there is substantial movement in the right direction. And I would encourage listeners to find out how you might get involved in your local community as well.
Kathleen Ballou is Northwestern University history professor and expert on far-right extremism. Kathleen, thank you so much.
Thank you.